Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dane Grenoville, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Cossum. Cossum is an entrepreneur, business coach, founder of 3X Freedom, and CEO of Pareto Talent, a premium executive assistant placement agency. Prior to founding his companies, Cossum held leadership positions in digital marketing, business development, and entrepreneurial ventures. In this episode, Dane joins Cossum for a wide-ranging conversation about what really makes teams work when talent, trust, and technology intersect. Together, they explore why trust functions as an invisible infrastructure in modern teamwork, why small teams consistently outperform bureaucratic ones, and what changes when exceptional people are amplified by AI rather than constrained by systems. The conversation also stretches beyond the organization, examining meaningful work, opportunity, and the role teams can play in expanding access to talent globally. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork. My name's Dane Grunewald, and today I'm talking to Cossum. Cossum's doing a bunch of cool work. One of his titles is co-founder of Pareto Talent, and he's also the author of Hire. So we're going to be talking a lot about those two today. There's the book right there, Hire. So tell us, Cossum, what brought you to be doing all this really cool work?
I made an exit. I built the number one ranked Google Ads agency in the world. I sold it for a small eight-figure sum in October of 2022. Yep. And the worst thing you can do to poor people is give us money because we think we become investors. And that's what I did, man. I started running around building businesses, and it's been the most fun I've ever had in my entire life. I have a portfolio of 17 entities, none of which I run day to day, all with varying degrees of revenue, but all net positive with, you know, two R&D exceptions. And I don't want to slow down or stop. So we'll see how far I can get, Dane.
That is awesome. I love the energy that comes with what it sounds like, this kind of opening up of opportunity to go and work with different teams rather than just being grinding it out with one.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I love where I am and I miss that.
Interesting.
I miss the ability to focus. I miss the sandbox. I miss the camaraderie. I miss the team atmosphere. I own a staffing agency that has, you know, we're approaching 100 EAs. So that's a pretty big team. And yeah. I'm disconnected from them. Like, they don't really know me. I don't really know them. And I'm so envious of my business partner who runs the business on a day-to-day because it's so much, it feels like summer camp, dude. Like, it's so much fun. I drop into Slack and I see the chatter and everybody, you know, like, it can get pretty lonely at the top. It's weird when rich people complain about being, you know, in that position, isn't it? So let me not be obnoxious, but.
There's actually a whole body of research on that. One of my former mentors, Rick Eigenbrode, actually wrote a paper on it. And it's a huge shift in identity structure and meaning. And I think people go through it when they go through exit. Some people go through it when they retire. I think on the flip, it's similar to perhaps like empty nesters when parents all of a sudden don't have kids to look after. Yeah. And so actually the research suggests that once that identity structure and meaning go, people do kind of get a little bit lost in, well, what next? And, you know, was that the best thing that'll ever happen? There's a whole bunch of different emotions that go through it. And that's a big reason that I have become attached to teams, because I think teams can help you find that identity structure and meaning. And, you know, I guess maybe one of the questions we're exploring here today too is like, can you be on multiple teams?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd love to read that paper.
I'll send it to you.
Show notes. Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And the multiple teams issue feels very accessible, and it's a spectrum. You know, I mean, the number of teams you are in dilutes the quality that you're able to, I think, extract and contribute to each team respectively, right?
So,
it would be so much fun. Naval Ravikant talks about this a lot. He's like, I play the same game with the same small group of people that I've been playing with for 20 years.
Yeah.
And what I really love about him is he puts more emphasis and value on the relational equity built than on the skill set of the person. Because if he's got one, just to sterilize the conversation for ease of communication, if he's got one software engineer, let's say, that he always works with, and there's another software engineer that down the street that you know is 20% better, that 20% isn't worth the trade-off of 20 years worth of, I know this guy, trust this guy, like this guy. You know, like we have a short-end communication. And so I think that teams go undervalued in that way.
I think it's a great point. And it reinforces this whole belief that trust is one of those core fuels of good teams.
Dude, I think trust is the cornerstone of the economy.
Yeah.
You know, it's ineffable. It can't be described. It can't be quantified, measured. And yet it's the thing. It's so weird to me still that I go onto a website, which is really just a collection of ones and zeros.
Yeah.
And then I see something, and then I send that something's owner money. And then a couple of days later, I actually get the thing. You know what I mean? Like, the trust established in that process between two people that will never meet and don't even communicate is insane. If you were to flash back and try to explain that to humanity, you know, pick your poison, 1,000 years ago or 100 years ago, or even really 50 years ago, like it sounds like madness.
Yeah.
It reminds me, there's this really fun meme that says, you know, 20 years ago, they said, don't get in the car with strangers. Don't talk to people on the internet. And then like you flash forward and now it's like summon strangers from the internet to give you a ride.
Like, it's so wild.
Yeah, it's unreal. And it's an extraordinary testament to us and humanity and like what we've been able to create. And the fact that I really do believe that every individual person is working towards something like a higher good.
Yes.
Which I know sounds naive, but I don't, the older I get, the more I believe that.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway.
I actually listened to a good podcast on that last week. Adam Grant was talking about moral ambition. How, you know, people at their very core, they do want to work towards a higher purpose. They're attached, they're grounded to this planet. There's a sense of wanting to leave something positive behind. Yeah. So it is fascinating.
It's, you know what, the best articulation of that, I think, is actually in the negative. When you see people that look to destroy, you know, like even vandalism and graffiti, what's really happening is that need not being articulated, and then somehow, like, otherwise, what would the point be outside of the fact of an acknowledgement of, you know, I can be a force for good, or if that's not allowed of me, or I don't feel like that's, you know, being properly exercised. So
that's a great point. That's a great point. Well, take me back to the book. So Hire, like what was it that brought you into, writing the book, and for anyone who's listening today, like what are some of the key messages, key themes that they should be excited to explore?
Yeah, I think that the only thing I'm really world-class at is talent acquisition. Uh-huh. In 20 years, I've built, you know, I've had 7 entities hit the 7 or 8 figure mark. I'm working on my 3rd exit, and I'm massively more successful than I deserve to be. Because if you think about it from an entrepreneurial perspective, and this is true, I think, in the corporate world too, I just have no experience in the corporate world. If you crack the talent code, there is nothing else for you to do. And I really mean that. That's not an exaggeration. If you're good at finding talent, tell me what else you have. What other tasks could possibly end up on your plate?
Yeah.
You know, so for entrepreneurs that are constant, if you feel like you're chasing your tail, trying to, oh gosh, you know, I mean, now my company's growing and I have to figure out the finance piece, or, you know, we just expanded and I need to build out this application, or we need to scale, we need to automate, we need to systemize, we need a knowledge base, we need to insert, I don't care what here.
Yeah.
You can either figure that out yourself, which by the way is everybody's inclination.
Yeah.
Or you can go cultivate one really accessible skill.
Yeah.
Which is talent acquisition. And I say acquisition, that's actually an unfair way to put it. It's learning to find and use talent. Because people utilize talent horribly, Dane. Horribly.
Yeah.
They find peak performers and then they just ruin them immediately. In 90 days, that peak performer has been destroyed. And so I think that the skill set are kissing cousins enough to where I'd put them in one bucket, which is talent. But if you can learn talent, there's nothing else left for you to do, which is why I wrote the book. I feel like it's the linchpin of all entrepreneurial endeavors. And it's not a philosophical book. It's actually it's a framework. It's a step-by-step, first this, then that, with very specific notes and tricks and tips and hacks. I call them fly traps, which is, it's my favorite topic in the whole wide world, if you wanted to touch on it. And it is an assembly line for top talent. 7 steps. You're 7 steps away from the greatest hire you've ever had in your entire life. And I'm not selling the book, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that to you. It's free.
Cool. So
the book is free. The audiobook is free. The cheat sheet is free. The workbook is free. All of the resources and templates are free. I want my name to be synonymous with the word hire. And yes. So the idea here is, I have always wondered about selling books. It's like, why would you charge someone $20 to be indoctrinated to your way of thinking?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That doesn't feel... So I'm not going to make my money off books. People can go to thehirebook.com and they can have everything for free. There's no ascension. There's no course on the back, and I'm not selling anything.
Cool.
And my hope is that I can equip people with the skills that would be necessary to hire not just top talent, but hopefully top talent in emerging nations, which is my passion.
Brilliant.
I want to help as many people in emerging nations find meaningful work as I possibly can.
That's very cool. I want to come back to the emerging nations part and the 7 steps, but... I'm going to take you up on your offer of fly traps and exploring why they're so energizing for you.
Do you mind a preface before I answer the question? So here's the preface is this. We're taught to hire and manage people like commodities, and we're taught to do that by every business book ever written. We talk about, think about, and speak about people as though they're commodities. And you know that just in the nomenclature. You might say, oh, I need to hire a graphic designer. That's a discussion of commoditization. Because a graphic designer, what does that mean? When you're hiring a person, you are hiring, depending on how you feel philosophically or religiously, you are hiring God incarnate. You are hiring a unique, literal miracle. You are hiring somebody with incalculable capabilities. And for you to go, graphic designer, put them in a box, it nullifies all that is valuable about humanity. And so we have to look at people as though they're miracles. And if you don't like that, by the way, stop listening to me. And to be honest with you, I hope you never have the opportunity to employ anybody, and you're put inside of a padded room, because the counter thesis to that is something like the lack of the acknowledgement of the value of the individual. Mm-hmm. Which, anyway, sorry, got really weird there. I won't soapbox anymore, Dane. So if a human is a miracle, this is the statistical truth, is those miracles are capable of so much more than we would presuppose. And you know that because of the Pareto distribution. 20% of the input is responsible for 80% of the output, which is true in all organic ecosystems. So 20% of the criminals commit 80% of the crimes. 20% of your customers are responsible for 80% of your revenue. 20% of the workforce does 80% of the work. And it's fractal, which blows my mind. People don't realize it's fractal. Let's take a 1,000-person organization, okay? There's 1,000 people in this organization. That means 200 people are doing 80% of the work. Wow. But you go, you know what? I've been in a 1,000-person organization before. I worked at a call center as a kid, and I saw that myself. But zoom in on those 200. Of those 200, 40 are doing 80% of that work. Zoom in on the 40, 8 are doing 80% of that work. Which comes down to, in a 1,000-person organization, one person is doing 25% of the work, roughly speaking. And this is the best part, Dane, is you can index towards the one. You can index towards the Pareto talent, because most organizations are actually trying to kill top talent. And then you'd ask, how do you do it? Here's my answer. You have to pay more. Mm-hmm. People hate this, by the way, because when you're buying commodities, the best way to buy a commodity is to pay the least for the most, right? So if we're buying corn, I want the most amount of corn for the least amount of money.
Yeah.
And the thing about corn is easily interchangeable. That's the definition of a commodity. If you have corn and I have corn and we swap, neither of us are better or worse off. With people, one graphic designer is not worth the other graphic designer. As illustrated by the Pareto distribution, if you have that one out of 1,000 that can do 24% of the global work, there is no equitable trade for that person. So when I tell people pay more, they say, oh gosh, I can't, you don't understand my model, my economics, my margins. And I say, no, you don't understand math. There's no way this doesn't math. And then they say, okay, well, how much more do we have to pay? And then I say 10% more than the high watermark. And then they go, okay. And they immediately misunderstand what I'm saying. If the role pays, just to use round numbers, let's say it pays 75 to 100 shekels, right? There's 75 to 100 shekels it takes to get this person in your organization. Because of the commodity thinking, the entrepreneur tries to pay 74.9,
yes,
for the best person they can get. And then I say, hey, pay 10% more. And they go, 10% more than 74.9. And I say, no. 10% more than the high watermark. If it's 75 to 100, I want you to pay 110. And then they throw up their hands and they say, Qasim, I can't do it. You're an idiot. There's no way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the thing. When you pay 10% more than the high watermark, you don't get 10% more output or 100% more output. You get 5 times, 10 times, 100 times. Yep. That's a better distribution. It can't not work in your favor. That point made, when you go to the market, this is why I like flight traps. When you go to the market and you publicly announce, I'm paying 10% more than the high watermark, and I like to pay 3 times, 5 times, whatever the local market is, especially in emerging nations.
Yeah.
In the Philippines, when everybody was paying their Filipino VAs $500 a month, I was paying $1,500 a month.
Yeah.
And now here's what happens. In some instances, Dane, I swear to God, without exaggeration, I got tens of thousands of applications, but almost always thousands of applications.
Yeah.
It's an impossible thing to sift through. So you have to have flight traps. So, for example, my job description read, in order to apply, your subject line has to read, I actually read the instructions. If the subject line didn't read that, then they were automatically filtered out. But it's a really strong indication that they should actually read the instructions, because the instructions will have five or six things they have to do. I want an English proficiency score if English proficiency is necessary, or you're going to be front-facing to a client. I want you to send me a link to a PDF resume with this naming convention. Do I care it's a link and not an attachment? No. Do I care it's PDF in Word? No. I just want to know you can stop, slow down, follow instructions. Yeah. So four, five, six things like that, personality tests, if you're an animal, what kind of animal would you be, just to see how thoughtful and creative they are. Uh-huh. Things that are relevant to the role. And when they apply, all of those little fly traps, filter, 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 filter. But you're not done. What conventional wisdom has taught us to do is to rely on resumes and interviews, which are, it's an abysmal metric. It's an abysmal metric because resumes tell you nothing. As a matter of fact, some of the best employees I've ever had in my entire life have all the red flags on their resumes. They have gaps in their resumes. They have backtracks. They have diminishment of roles. They have irrelevant roles. Things that an HR representative will be like, well, we can't hire him because, you know, there's... So ignore resumes entirely, especially in the contemporary world that is the 21st century that has shown us people have a very dynamic work history. And interviews are worthless because... unless you're hiring somebody to be a professional interviewer, it's an arbitrary skill set. It's superfluous to every job that's ever existed. Yep. And people that are good at interviewing aren't going to be the best employees and vice versa. So here's what you do. You get your shortlist after they've gone through everything and you filter out according to the fly traps. And you find the people that you actually think might be adept based solely on the fly trap process. And then you reach out. So you apply for a job and you're able to hurdle all my fly traps. I come back, I say, Dane, thank you so much. I really appreciate your application. I love people who follow instructions. I'm really excited about you, but I've been hiring for 20 years and I know interviews and resumes tell me nothing. I'm not going to really know whether or not you're a fit for this until we've worked together. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to pay you in advance for a trial project. Here's the scope of work of the trial project. If you're interested, send me your PayPal or your Wise or your Payoneer or whatever is applicable for that geography. If they agree, they always do. They send you the PayPal. Here's the trick. You always pay something. It's not going to make anybody rich, but some amount of money that justifies 2 hours. So in the Philippines, $20 is great. $20 for 2 hours worth of work, awesome. In Latin America, you might have to pay 40. Whatever it is, you send this out to your shortlist, which is 10 or 20 people, and you say, send me your PayPal. When they send me the PayPal, I pay them in advance, and then I don't follow up, and I don't send them the trial project. And then I wait. And I get to see who ghosts me, who's unethical, who forgets. I have people follow up a month later saying, hey, you sent me $40 and you never sent me the trial project. And I'm like, yes, and I'm so glad I didn't hire you. Imagine that. So the people that come back and say, where's my trial project? I send them the project. The project has to be applicable to the role. If you're hiring a graphic designer, give them a graphic design project. If you're hiring a client manager, a salesperson, a software engineer, doesn't matter. Give them a project that's applicable to the role, but do not give them a check the box project. Give them a project that requires them to problem solve, think constructively. And what I like to do is I like to send projects that are incomplete because I want iterative communication. I want to go back and forth. I want to see how they manage the client or manage internal teams or ask questions. And I'll also do things like when I finally send you the trial project, I'll say, okay, great. You know, here's the project. So excited. When do you think this is going to be done? Never give them deadlines. Because I want to know they're a remote worker. I want to know they can manage expectations, communicate. And so let's say it's Friday. And or it's Monday and you tell me it's going to be done by Friday. Okay, just as an example. Great. Awesome. Thanks, Dan. Can't wait till Friday. By the way, everything, all the assets you need to complete the project are in this drive file or whatever. Here's the username and password. Yeah. I give them the wrong password. And then I wait to see how long until they figure it out. So if Thursday night, I get a frantic email saying, the password isn't right. Now I know you're a procrastinator. And you know what I mean? So that doesn't necessarily preclude you from the project, depending on the instance, because very often that's everybody. But I like to know, and it keeps them on their toes. By the time you go through all my fly traps, and my book has literally hundreds, the people that complete the trial project, I always make them present the trial project on camera via Loom, because I want to see, can you support Loom. Work? Yeah. Can you explain your thinking? You could, don't, but you could hire just from the trial projects. Because anybody who walks through that process and produces something that you like is already a bloodthirsty assassin. They're already one of the best people you're ever going to hire. Do the interview because you don't want to build an entitlement. And then in the interview, I have a whole bunch of interview questions I really like. We can go over if you want to. I don't want to bore you. But dude, it's not uncommon for me to hire two or three people when I'm only looking for one.
Yeah.
Because this process produces so many extraordinary humans. And I like hiring in groups because if you put a horse out on the track by themselves, they're never going to run fast. And it builds camaraderie. And it helps you know where your fail points are. So anyway, this is, I built the number one ranked Google Ads agency in the world. Mm-hmm. I've never run a Google Ad campaign myself and in my life.
That's cool.
I went and found the talent, right? That's what I was able to do. I had the highest performing real estate investment campaign on the planet before I knew anything about real estate lead generation. I own the largest English speaking Montessori community in the world. I'm not a trained Montessorian. I don't have a Montessori school. I have a 10th grade education, but I know how to find people.
Yes.
And this is the process, and it works for every industry and every role except outbound sales.
Interesting.
Outbound sales. Because my thesis is outbound salespeople know how to go kick down the door and get a job. So if you have somebody who's waiting around to get a job and walking through this process, they're probably not going to be good at kicking down doors.
Yeah.
But every other role I've ever had to hire for in the 20 years of my career and thousands of people now hired, this, and once what's great about it is once you have it built, it's an assembly line.
Yes.
You know, unless you need to change the trial project because of some level of obsolescence or change in SOPs or whatever, it's the gift that keeps giving. It's the forever funnel. It's like, oh, we need another client manager. Turn the thing on. And you do. And then you get a client manager out of it. And what's really cool is you start to build a pool and a repository because you'll produce more extraordinary hires than you can hire.
Yes.
And so what I like to do is just go back to that list and say, hey, we're ready for you. Are you ready for us?
Yeah. Yeah. That's super cool. I mean, having grown up recruiting talent my whole life, I can, I'm just smiling and nodding because I can see a lot of really, really good design in that whole process of bringing those flytraps to bear.
Yeah, thanks, man. This is the thing I'm most proud of professionally. None of this is really mine. It's all stolen from various thought leaders and friends and, you know, competitors over 20 years. But I think I'm Frankenstein, right? Like I've pulled together, I think, the best monster anybody's pulled together.
Yeah.
Which also means feel free to take it, modify it, you know, change it.
Which is cool.
Yeah. I give everybody in the little packet all the templates that would be necessary. So the email templates, the job posting template, the job description is so important. So many businesses, go to any job posting board right now, go to Jobbing or Indeed or whatever. And when you read it, it reads, it's like, you must comply with all rules or regulations or you will be publicly flogged. You know, and it's like, what world do we live in that you think a peak performer is going to apply for that job?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like stuff like that, I have some guardrails to help people.
It's tricky on that point. I mean, there's a couple of data points that jump out. I think there's an interesting one on gender that women won't apply unless they meet like 70% of what's in the advertisement, where men are far more cavalier and they'll go in if they only meet 30%.
Yeah. So I've read a study that was similar. It says that a woman won't submit herself for a promotion unless she's 100% compliant with the needs, and a man will apply at 70%, which is interesting because in my organizations, almost, and this gets real sexist real quick, I imagine I can get sued, but almost all of my best, especially as you hire from within for upper management, all of my best employees were female.
Yep.
My onboarding manager, Angelia, was female. The director of automations, Julianne, was female. Our director of social, Audie, was female. My COO, who managed my exit, was female. Leandra, she was extraordinary. And in every instance, I had to pull them up. They were like, no, I'm not ready. And I'm like, trust me, you're ready.
Yeah.
So I think it's really worth for business leaders who aren't paying attention, pay attention to your female employees, because there is, and you know, you can tell me there's not a difference, and I'd argue with you. For some weird reason, we're in this weird narrative where I don't even know how to have this conversation anymore. But temperamentally, women want the security of knowing that they really are, they check all the boxes.
Yeah.
And they, I think they need to be coached on the fact that, no, you're the most qualified person here. They also, and this is actually kind of sad in so many ways, they retain better. My male employees, the average tenure at Solutions 8 for a male employee was just around 2 years. And for a female employee, it's actually hard to say because we ended up selling the business, but, you know, would have been in excess of 3.5. They stuck forever, which inhibits their career growth because the more you bounce, the more upward mobility you have. So yeah, there's a lot there, dude, to discuss.
There is a lot. It's interesting because Professor Scott Galloway, who I enjoy following.
Bro, I'd cuddle with him if you let me.
Yeah, I'm with you. We should start a club. Cuddle with Scott Club. But what's interesting is he's obviously talking a lot about how men are struggling right now. And one of the points that I think ties to what you just shared is that men tend to be risk takers. We're kind of anatomically and socially, we're brought up to be risk takers, whether that's going off to war or whatever else. I know all of these things are changing. We're living in a changing time, but a lot of this programming kind of goes down through multiple generations. And so I think we are seeing on both sides of that coin, we're seeing, you know, some of the women who have not been the risk takers and are being cautious and waiting to fully achieve before they go forward. And we're seeing some of the men that are going forward without having the capabilities or the attributes. And there's outliers in both, but it is interesting as you look at teams and you, to your point, you try and pull the right people up, because let's be honest, most organizations in the last 30 years are guilty of over promoting the people who are asking to take on the risks and creating a trail of chaos behind those promotions. So I think that's it's a fascinating piece that probably deserves a lot more research and exploration.
There's a name of a phenomenon. I forget the name. We've termed it, but basically it states that every person is going to be promoted to their first layer of incompetence. Do you know what I'm talking
about? Yes, yeah, I do, yeah.
So it's like you get a job, you do a great job, and we promote you. And you do a great job there, and we promote you. And you do a great job there, and we promote you. And you suck at that job, and that's where you stay.
Yeah.
And it's like everybody gets promoted all the way to where they suck.
Yeah.
You know, which is, it's like, how do you, that's why, you know, it's so funny, dude. I sell businesses before they get big enough to where they get bureaucratic, because I don't know how to manage for that. When Solutions 8 got to almost 100 employees, and I felt the culture get away from me.
Yep.
I felt an inability to influence certain things. There were things happening that I actually, frankly, didn't like or didn't agree with. And, you know, I just sold that business because I don't know how to solve for a bureaucratic environment. I can't imagine having thousands of employees and still treating everybody like they're a miracle. I don't know how that's done. I think that's why small businesses, especially right now in the AI age, have such a competitive advantage.
Huge advantage. And I want to come back to that too, because I agree with you. When I started the podcast on the future of teamwork, one of my beliefs that I wanted to go out and explore in the world is that small teams win because they don't have the bureaucracy and because they are able to be more fluid. I don't want to use the word agile, but more fluid and maybe make more of the miracle essence in those teams.
Well, I don't think that can be argued any longer. I think it's 101,000 to one times the innovation comes from a teeny, 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 tiny team. And some people like to point it like, well, what about, you know, I'm struggling to find an example. But even if you were to point at Google and what they just recently did with image generation, it's a micro team that has been cut off from the source and let be mavericks, because they figured out like this doesn't work when you're part of the hive. So they take four people and they put them in a room and then they coke them up, basically, is what you know what I mean? It's like, here's everything you'll ever want, and just don't talk to us until you come back with something that's worth $1 billion.
Yeah, well, I share that, but I think in popular culture, everyone continues to look towards the Fortune 500 and, hey, there's a large cost of research and development and maintaining these operations in regulated environments. So I think it's interesting that you selected innovation as the measure. I totally agree with that. I think there's other measures that people will still go towards scaled teams and scaled organizations for. But it is fascinating. But coming back to this small teams win concept, I know before the show, Cosim, we were talking about weaponization of the workforce with AI coming in. And that was before you'd explained to me the fractal nature of Pareto, that you might have one person in a 1,000-person company that's bringing 25% of the value. So when you take that one person and you wrap them with AI or AI, you know, augmented team members, what then? I'm intrigued.
Really, what then? So we're figuring this out together, all of us. My biggest pain point in life has always been that I don't know how to clone people.
Yeah.
You know, like, cause I'm really good at finding top talent. And then I'm like, oh, I wish I had another Yvonne. I wish I had another Leandra. And then you can actually index in that direction too, because you now have a buy box, you know what works for this role. And so that's really helpful to have. But to take a person like that, to take someone that is just extraordinary, is just truly a miracle, and then put them in a position with these trillion-dollar computing mechanisms to scale their work to degrees, the word exponential doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
The word limitless is probably a better word.
Interesting.
Because they're really, the limit to the scale isn't in the production, it's in the appetite, it's in the ability to consume.
Yes.
So like if I have the best, just to for an easy role to talk about, which is why it's my go-to example, is graphic design, because everybody's used it or has it or whatever. So if you have the best graphic designer in the world using a really phenomenal AI-driven graphic design tool, so now you have somebody that understands things like, you know, brand temperament and the intellectual connection between colors and soft lines and white space and all that stuff. They could produce more designs than you could ever use a review. So
yes.
We're not talking about exponential. We're talking about unlimited, infinite scale, which I, to be honest with you, still have a difficult time wrapping my mind around the implications of.
Yeah.
First, sadly, I think it heralds a labor collapse. I think we're looking at UBI in the face. Yeah. I think 10 years from now, that's going to be an absolute presupposition. The fact that people argue with that right now, I think is hysterical. I'm like, you are not paying attention. But it's Sean Putty had a great note. I don't know if he made this up or just shared it, but he called it the K-shaped economy.
Yes.
So the base of the K is the time right now. The downward trending leg of the K is 80% of the workforce falls to zero productivity. The upward trending K is the 20% that produces
hyper productivity.
And again, hyper. I wish I told you earlier. I was like, it's impossible to hyperbolize.
Yeah.
You can't exaggerate. You can't give appropriate. You can't wrap your head around the impact of the scalability of your best people. I mean, and if you try, you're doing yourself a disservice.
Yeah.
We need to stop thinking in terms of quantity when it comes to personnel.
Interesting.
Because your best people can now be cloned in so many ways, and cloned isn't even the right way to think about it, because then you just think carbon copy, 1 + 1 = 2. And it's they can be scaled. And I'm watching, you know, the other thing is, this isn't theory. I'm watching this in action now. I'm seeing this with certain roles. We own a company, me and three partners own a company that does a very specific type of build out for high level, which is a SaaS application a lot of people know of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a super niche agency, and we built it because I've got an audience and my partner has an audience in that realm. And what's crazy about it, dude, is 5 years ago, to run the business we're currently running, I would have needed 50 people.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just hired our fourth.
Wow.
And the only bottleneck is talking to customers. It's just the human to human.
Yeah.
It's the back end is bam, 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 bam. Can't get it done fast enough. It's just, it's unreal and also terrifying that I own a company that would have taken 50, now takes 4.
Yes.
You know, and the 4, I probably could cut to 2 really, except I don't have the time to figure out how to auto, you know what I mean? Or the inclination and I just like them and we have the margins to do it.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way that all of us need to start thinking. And it's so exciting in so many ways because there is no limitation to what you can build and create.
Yeah.
You know, but it also means that there are a lot of what will we call them? If you think of an assembly line, there's the beginning of the assembly line is the input of, you know, here's what we want, here are all the materials, here's the scope of work, here's whatever. The end of the assembly line is your desired end product, your desired end goal. And then there's the middle points of the assembly line. So many businesses don't realize this. They're a middle point of the assembly line. They actually have nothing to do with the beginning, the ideation, or the end, the final product. If you're in the middle point of an assembly line, uh-oh. You know what I mean? Like immediate forced obsolescence. It's on the horizon. It's just you and your supply chain haven't figured that out yet.
Yes. So
get out of the middle. Be the beginning or be the end. And I think the beginning is safest. The end is really, really, it's a great place to be if you got a lot of money, if you're publicly traded or a big conglomerate or whatever, and you benefit from the scale, awesome. But the beginning, the catalyst, the ideation, what I tell my team, I own an EA agency. So EAs are easy to replace with AI in so many ways, unless, and this is the key, are you the promptor or the prompted?
Mm-hmm.
If you are being prompted, it's over for you. And so if you're listening to this and you're an employee and your job is to wait for somebody to tell you what you do, you are universal basic income. Like you're the 80%, you're the downward trending K. go find a way to be the promptor.
Yes.
Be proactive. Hey, I think we should do this. This is the idea. This is the gap. This is the need. This is the whatever. This is the, but catalyze the endeavor. And I believe that, to be honest with you, you'll be necessary forever.
Yeah. I've got a really interesting question on that for you, Kusum. When I studied geography at high school and we looked at unemployment and we said, well, the interesting thing about unemployment is that there's all of these people here, but they're geographically unemployed. They could go and work over here in the big city, but they're in a rural area and there aren't as many jobs, for example. Nowadays, I don't think of that as a geographical unemployment issue. I actually think of it like organizational. Like, I think there are people in organizations, I'm gonna use the word underemployed, that are sitting there saying, hey, my job is a graphic designer, but going back to your point, I'm a miracle. I've got capabilities, beliefs, interests that are far beyond what I'm doing here or what I could do here. And therefore, is that individual, as you look at the upward strike of the K, is that individual going to be sitting here saying, do I go and find a few teammates in my organization and start innovating within the organization? Or do I go out and side hustle? Or maybe do I just go out and start my own thing? Like, where do you think the future is going to be for those team members in terms of getting to the front, getting to the beginning of a process?
I'll say something that I hope isn't too slanderous to our collective environment. I understand who your listeners are, and I don't want to offend.
Yeah.
And I do think that larger organizations, if a hierarchical structure is shaped like a pyramid, functional hierarchy shaped like a pyramid, your most valuable assets move to the top of the pyramid, regardless of what we're talking about. Talking about talent, your highest producers move to the top of the pyramid. The larger the organization, the more they try to flatten the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
They insist on things like minimums, quotas, and if they have Pareto talent, meaning one person providing an excess, they actually look at it as a key man insurance problem. It's an existential crisis on a spreadsheet. And so what they do is they kill that person on the spreadsheet, right? It's like, oh, you know, when I sold Solutions 8, one person was managing 40% of the revenue out of almost 80 employees and 20-some-odd contractors. One person, his name's John Moran, greatest Google Ads mind in the world.
Yeah.
A Goldman Sachs Ivy League manager would come in and be like, can't have that. Spread that across other employees. But what they don't realize is you kill the Pareto talent. You kill John and you kill the clients that were all really happy to be with John. If you're in that organization, you have to get out. There's no room for you to do the thing that would be necessary to weaponize yourself. They actually don't want it. It's not incentivized. It's not to their benefit. It's not to yours.
Yeah.
So my first question is, does the organization allow for the expansion of you and your role that would be necessary in order for you to really articulate your prowess? And if the answer is no, then I think you need to jump. I'm of the very, very, very strong belief that most people are not entrepreneurs.
Uh-huh.
And that's okay. It's actually better. Non-entrepreneurial people, I think, are better, more ethical, more sound. Douglas Brackman wrote this book called Driven. He talked about the epigenetic phenomenon of entrepreneurism. And basically, one out of 20 people they're broken in terms of dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin receptors. Entrepreneurs only experience those things in pursuit of a goal, where 95% of the world experiences them upon the completion of a goal. So if you're not an entrepreneur, that's okay.
Yeah.
But go find a small, nimble, entrepreneurial community that would allow for you to contribute in a way that feels not just meaningful, but also that your interests are aligned, which means pay per hour, I think, has something of a fuse on it.
Interesting.
How could it not? Especially in an AI world. Because if I'm the best graphic designer in the whole world, it's got to be product.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, like paying for my hour doesn't make sense for me. And honestly, it doesn't make sense for you. It doesn't make sense for either of us, the employer or the employee. It's like, hey, we need a really amazing thing. It's like, well, I have the mind and the pedigree and the case studies to show you I'm capable of a really amazing thing. What is a really amazing thing worth? Not what is my hour worth?
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, people argue with that with me all the time. And I don't know where that goes. I still have a ton of employees that are salaried or pay per hour or whatever, but I can see a situation and a horizon, especially for, you know, more functional entities where you just, that's not the way that this thing is going to work.
Correct. Yeah. That's interesting. So I'm hearing if that's if you've got this capability to be that Pareto talent and your organization isn't creating the conditions for you to achieve that, then you've got to leave. Do you think it's a bridge it with a side hustle, go and get in one of those entrepreneurial communities and start finding the work first? Or do you think we're getting to a point in time where you don't have to be worried about being without something to do? If you've got that talent, you're going to be able to just land and find it quickly.
No, I wouldn't burn the boats. I'm more of a prepper, and I catastrophize. I think it's interesting. I think AI in 100 years is the best thing that ever happened to humanity. In 50 years, it's bloodshed and warfare. I do think that we should be very careful. I think that especially given the regime changes that the Western world is used to, it'll take time for us to stabilize and to settle. So, the worst advice people give to entrepreneurs is go all in, bet on yourself. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Keep the paycheck, build. And then once you're 80% satiated, then you can walk. The advice I'll give the children, if you don't mind my playing graveyard a little, I have a YouTube video on this I can share with you. I call it The Money Machine. The way that we teach people to use money is pernicious and evil. The whole world is on this merry-go-round where for every dollar I give you, I've incentivized you to spend $1.10.
Yeah.
And the thing that's unfair to say and people hate to hear, dude, I'm a welfare baby, Kay. I came from nothing. I'm not a trust fund kid throwing grenades. Live beneath your means.
Uh-huh.
For God's sake. And if you can do, and if you live in a house, live in a condo. If you live in a condo, live in a trailer. If you live in a trailer, rent a room. You know, like there's this a priori prerequisite minimum lifestyle that everybody needs it blows my freaking mind.
Yeah.
What people think is like necessary. And the minimum, every human in the Western world lives better than any aristocratic person 200 years ago.
Yeah.
Like just air conditioning and penicillin.
Yeah, totally. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Like so
baths.
Yes. So go live beneath your freaking means. Eat beans and rice.
Yeah.
Don't have the new car. Drive a 20-year-old Toyota. Those things are tanks.
Yeah.
Live with your parents. And what it does is it puts you in a position of what Nassim Nicholas Taleb calls optionality.
Yes.
And that optionality cannot, what would I say? That's the pivot point from which true opportunity is birthed. And if you don't have that optionality, the number of opportunities you have access to diminish from close to infinite to maybe four.
Yeah.
Right? Because now your buy box is, well, it has to pay this much and it has to be close to this place that I bought. And it has to, you know, whatever. I need somewhere to park my new car. Like just all this garbage that if you're under 40 and you don't have children, the position of luxury that you are in, dude, like, oh, good golly. So stop keeping up with the Joneses, stop buying new stuff, stop eating out, increase your income, decrease your expenses, have margin. And then the conversation that we're having is a lot easier to give advice from.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's really good positioning. And I followed a little bit the FIRE movement here in the U.S., the financial
independent. You know, it's funny, the guy who started that went back and got a job. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't. That's interesting. But that also doesn't surprise me because I think one of the things about that movement that bothered me, if you're financially independent, retire early, you're not thinking about what the future is going to bring in terms of increased costs of living and opportunities.
Dude, that's what happened to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, I can't afford, I think he lives in San Francisco and he has kids. He's like, I can't afford to do the things I want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that whole thesis was absurd. I remember reading an article about him and he's like, he basically said, I spend my whole day watching Netflix. And that type of temperament disgusts me. You know, I'm like, if you've got that time, write a book, you know, like
do something,
paint give a painting,
back.
Do something meaningful, go volunteer to soup kitchen. Like, that weird, I just want to like zone out and vegetate. That's to my mind. And, you know, I'm speaking as somebody who loves somebody who spent 6 years in prison for addiction.
Yeah.
And it's the mentality of an addict.
Yes.
You just want to sit in front and watch TV all day, like you're an addict. Like at best, I love you and I'd love to get you some help, but that should be nobody's aspiration.
Yeah. Yeah. The people that I experienced that were following that movement were doing it with more wholesome causes, like go travel the world, volunteer in third nations.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
You, when you achieve freedom, you want freedom of purpose.
Correct.
You know, yeah. It's like, and then everybody's got something. You've got the rainforest or the dolphins or Palestine, or like there's a group of humans that you want to help, or a group of people or a cause or something that you want to serve.
Yeah.
And that would be the hope, is as we free people, we allow them to pursue the greater purpose.
Like it. And that brings me to my final question for you, which is working with top talent in emerging nations. There's something very fascinating there for me. What is it that's capturing and creating energy for you in that work?
So believe it or not, it's not the financial arbitrage,
mm-hmm.
Which is what people assume. If you gave me the option right now and you said, hey, you know, the worldwide government got together and passed a law that everybody has to be paid the same, I'd still be going internationally. And I'm going to say a bunch of things that are horribly offensive. Ready? I mentioned earlier, I'm a welfare baby. I was raised by a blind single mother on Social Security disability in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And people hear that and like, oh, poor you. And I'm like, no. It's a lot like being a trust fund baby, because the United States Social Security Office fed me, clothed me, housed me, educated me. We as a country, and then I'll use the broader Western society, we won. We won. We did it. Nobody really needs to work.
Yeah.
Well, here's what that means. Does the U.S., and I'll, again, try not to limit our scope, forgive me, because I realize that I'm speaking to an audience that could be international. Does the rest of the world produce extraordinary top talent? Yes, of course we do, right? But if you're in what I think the PC term is the West, those people go to where? They go to Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook.
Big platforms.
They go to, I'm giving stock options, a startup, and I can make you a millionaire.
Yeah.
Or they strike out on their own, because it's easier to be an entrepreneur here than it is anywhere else in the world. Which means that small business owners are left with the leftovers. And now I've got a cousin like this who I love to death. He's a great father. He's a great husband. He loves to barbecue. He loves to play. Work is number 9 on his list, dude. Clock in, clock out. And he makes $120,000 a year as a supervisor at a call center. That is not a $120,000 value job. But for some reason, we have this weird microcosm of a world where he can make that doing that and not even be good at it, and he's not, as much as I love him. I hope he never listens to this. Flip, go to Bogota, Colombia. Go to the Philippines. Go to Vietnam. Go to Eastern Europe. Go to North Africa. Go to places that don't have the exposure of opportunity. They produce the same percentage of extraordinary talent with a micro fraction of the number of opportunities. The people that I have access to, you experience something that as a Western employer you'll never experience if you only hire domestically, which is gratitude.
Yeah.
You know, if you really want people that work hard, go to where people are hungry, literally and figuratively. Yeah. Pay them more than they could ever make domestically. That has anthropological significance, by the way. The impact that you have on people's lives is staggering. And you get people that will run through walls for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say, scream whatever you want to scream. You're stealing American jobs, or you're exploiting people. No, and no. I'm giving jobs away that people didn't want in the first damn place. And I can tell you that because I've tried to hire the locals and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It does not work because they do not work. And go international and pay them more than they could ever make domestically. How's that exploitation, you know?
Yeah.
But it ruffles everybody's feathers to varying degrees. And I can tell you, dude, it's the greatest thing I've ever done for myself professionally. And I've been so awed by the talent that's available in international markets. I have a personal CFO who manages the you know, financial health of my entire portfolio of companies. He's a college professor. Mm-hmm. The poor guy, if he was born in the States, he'd work for a Fortune 1000 as at least director level.
Yeah.
You know, he's a 7-figure guy, dude. Born on the wrong side of some bullshit arbitrary line.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is life fair? No. Do I love him? Does he love me? Yes. Are we lucky to have each other? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a philosophical conversation about the pernicious evil that is the petrodollar and the fact that the United States suppresses everybody's economy at the tip of a spear that we all know is absolutely true. And if you study the Federal Reserve, you know that it's satanic. Okay, great. I'll sign that petition. But until that's gone and we're not holding people to this arbitrary evil, this is the best that we can do.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that you frame it the way that you do, and you talk about A, gratitude, which I'm a huge believer of in teams, and B, this anthropological impact. A big part of my work is that the best teams don't just return work for each other and shareholders and customers, they return work to their communities and opportunity to their communities. And I think it's a perfect point. So thank you for bringing that up. It's been fun. There's been so much we've covered and so much we could still go and cover. I loved your fly traps and that singular role of a leader to be really good at talent acquisition, activation, whatever you want to call it. I think that's very cool. I loved in particular the responsiveness that you invite in future talent that you bring into the organization. Hiring in groups, I know we didn't dive deep in that, but I think that is powerful. It's proven that when people come together to get through an event, which may just simply be onboarding, it creates an epiphany effect. It creates bonding, helps create more in the future. But this whole mindset around weaponized talent and limitless opportunity when we're putting the AI and the right people with the right technologies is something I want to spend a lot more time in. And particularly, how you can do that, extending what you're clearly doing to people in emerging countries. So thank you for sharing your story. The book we'll put in the show notes, the fact that that's available. It'd be great to see some of our listeners get back to you or us on how that's going for them. How do they best find you in general?
Kasim.me, KASIM.me, a link to my portfolio businesses, a link to the book, all my socials. Cool. I'd love to be friends. And yeah. I really appreciate you having me on, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Kasim. It's been a blast.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.